Isaiah, chapters 47 and 48, the 30th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on April 13, 2014, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be looking at Isaiah's chapter 47 and 48. In this section, starting with chapter 40, there's a significant break in the text between 39 and 40. In this section, starting in 40, the context seems to be that Isaiah is addressing people of Israel about 120 to 150 years into the future after Isaiah was writing. And at that time, the people of Judah had been conquered by the Babylonians, taken into exile to Babylon. They're living in Babylon. And then what Isaiah is talking about is he has hinted that there will be a conqueror coming who is going to conquer Babylon and is going to return them to Israel to rebuild Israel and to rebuild the temple. So that's the context in which this is being spoken. It's being spoken to Israelites in captivity in Babylon. And there's been a lot of talk about idolatry, and Isaiah has denounced idolatry, and he's talking about idolatry in general, but the gods of Babylon are in his sights as well. And so he's denouncing the idolatry that exists in Babylon. And it would have been tempting for the Jews living in Babylon to embrace the gods of Babylon because Judah was the country that was taken captive, and they were moved as captives from Judah to Babylon. So in the way of thinking, in the ancient mind, that means your God is weak. On the other hand, Babylon has created an empire that's bigger than any empire that's existed in that area ever, and is at the height of their power. And therefore, one would, given their perspective, one would think that their gods are the most powerful. And Babylon is not just powerful, it's culturally sophisticated. And that too has its attraction. So that is the context into which Isaiah is speaking and trying to make the case that, trying to convince his listeners that Yahweh is the conductor of history. That the reason that the Jews are in Babylon is not because Yahweh's weak, but because Yahweh's doing something through that process. That he is disciplining his people. And in fact, what he's doing in history is what he has said that he would do in history. He's carrying out the purposes that he established right from the beginning. Everything is on track. And God is well in control of all historical events, including Babylon itself. Chapter 47 then fits very well into that context, and it is a lament for Babylon describing the inglorious future that awaits Babylon. So the first section. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. For you shall no longer be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind meal. Remove your veil, strip off the skirt, uncover the leg, cross the rivers. Your nakedness will be uncovered, your shame also will be exposed. I will take vengeance and will not spare a man. Our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, is his name, the Holy One of Israel. So this is a lament for Babylon, but it's not really a lament. It's kind of a I don't know if I call it a celebration of Babylon's downfall, but it's just describing how far down Babylon is going to come. It says, come and sit in dust. Dust is, to sit in the dust is to be defeated. In the ancient Near East, that's is typically the symbolism of dust is in defeat. It says, O virgin daughter of Babylon. I'm not sure why the term virgin. One commentator suggested because Babylon was unconquered. I suppose in the time in which Isaiah is writing to, Babylon was unconquered. But I'm not sure exactly why the term virgin is used. And sit on the ground without a throne, suggesting that demotion from sitting on the throne in power, now in defeat on the ground in the dust. And then you shall no longer be called tender and delicate. That Babylon is pictured as this virgin woman who is tender and delicate, all suggesting being high-born. And that, at this point, she is no longer. Verse 2 then is talks about some of the ways in which this virgin has been brought down. Take millstones and grind meal. Grinding flour was one of the lowliest occupations in the ancient Near East. It was one of the least desirable. It was slaves that did it. Remove your veil, strip off the skirt. The veil and a long skirt would have been the clothing of the highborn. That's all to come off. Uncover your legs, so the long skirt is gone, and all there is the short tunic. And that would have been the clothing of a slave. Cross the rivers. In all likelihood, that's talking about wading through the canals. So we're working in the fields doing agricultural work. So all of these are suggestions of how far down she's fallen. This is not the Babylon who was the queen and tender and delicate. Your nakedness will be uncovered. So there's no more pretense to greatness anymore. It's clear where this virgin daughter stands. Your shame will be exposed because God is going to take vengeance, and we see later what that vengeance is for. The next phrase, I have and will not spare a man, that is a difficult construction in Hebrew, and I think what makes the most sense is no one will get in God's way. No man will stop me. It could be translated. So no one will prevent God from carrying out his plan and executing the vengeance that he will execute. All of this is spoken by the Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, the Holy One of Israel. And we've heard those phrases used often with respect to God in this section, especially Redeemer and the Holy One of Israel. Next section. Sit silently and go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you will no more be called the queen of kingdoms. I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage and gave them into your hand. You did not show mercy to them. On the aged, you made your yoke very heavy. Yet you said, I shall be a queen forever. These things you did not consider, nor remember the outcome of them. So, this fallen daughter is to sit silently and to go into darkness. This is the word for darkness here is the same as the word for darkness in Genesis. And I was talking to my daughter was here visiting. We were talking about this theme, that a theme that is frequently repeated in the Old Testament is this theme of creation, of chaos becoming ordered, and vice versa, order becoming chaotic. And I think this is another suggestion of that order becoming chaotic. And my daughter is working on this hypothesis that the Exodus is also a recapitulation of the creation. And I'm suspicious that there's something to that, that those two things go together, creation and then God's various instances in which he brings his people out of slavery. They all have a kind of new creation feel to them. So I suspect that that's related here. Go sit silently and go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you will no longer be called queen of the kingdom. So she's being no longer as Babylon then, the supreme country of the world, kingdom of the world. Now, what happened? How did this come about? It all came about because God was angry with his people. That's why Babylon became powerful. Because God wanted to use it as a tool to accomplish his purposes with respect to his people. Not because Babylon is inherently great. I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage. And that's why God then gave them into Babylon's hands. But Babylon did not show mercy to them. Babylon laid a very heavy yoke on the aged of them. So God gave them over into Babylon's hands, but Babylon did not treat them well. Babylon was abusive and arrogant towards them. And as a result, I think that's the cause for the vengeance that it was talking about in verse 3. So God is going to extract vengeance because of their arrogance. And Babylon said, I shall be a queen forever. We'll see this later. But the thinking of Babylon was, my greatness is inherent in me, and it will persist forever. My greatness is a given, and I don't have to worry about falling low. But Babylon did not consider these things and did not remember the outcome of it. And the outcome is going to be judgment. The next section, verses 8 through 11, first verse is essentially repeated. So 8 is essentially repeated in 10, at least in content. And 9 is essentially repeated in 11. I'll read it. Now then, hear this, you sensual one, who dwells securely, who says in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, nor shall I know loss of children. But these two things shall come on you suddenly in one day, loss of children and widowhood. They shall come on you in full measure, in spite of your many sorceries, in spite of the great power of your spells. And you felt secure in your wickedness and said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge, they have deluded you, for you have said in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. But evil will come on you, which you will not know how to charm away. A disaster will fall on you, for which you cannot atone, and destruction about which you do not know will come on you suddenly. So verses 8 and 10 is talking about the attitude that Babylon has. And the attitude that Babylon has is that Babylon is like a god. It starts out, now then, hear this, you sensual one. So this is God speaking and describing Babylon, and that term, we'll see that later when I talk in the conclusion. Who dwells securely, who says in your heart, I am and there is no one besides me. That is essentially what God said about himself. Babylon is pretending to that same position. And Babylon is saying, I won't be a widow. I won't know the loss of children. In other words, Babylon is arguing, is claiming that she will never have the big losses. She will never experience those kinds of things. God's response is, in verse 9, two things are going to come on her, on Babylon, suddenly, and you'll see suddenly three times in this section. What are those two things that will come upon Babylon? Loss of children and widowhood. The very two things that Babylon said would never happen to her. Both of those are going to come suddenly in one day. And they're going to come in spite of all of Babylon's efforts to ward them off. Through sorcery, through charms, through magic, through all of Babylon's arts to control the spiritual world. Then verse 10 and 11 essentially, in content, repeat those two ideas. Okay, the next section, starting with 12. Stand fast now in your spells and in your many sorceries with which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you will be able to profit. Perhaps you may cause trembling. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars, those who predict by the new moons, stand up and save you from what will come upon you. Behold, they have become like stubble. Fire burns them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There will be no coal to warm by, not a fire to sit before. So have those become to you with whom you have labored, who you have trafficked with from your youth. Each has wandered in his own way. There is none to save you. This is kind of a taunt to the people of Babylon. He's saying, stand by your spells and your sorcery. Those are things that you've been engaged in from your childhood. They're a big part of your life. You have attributed much of your success to those magic arts. So now, stand by those. Now in a time of trouble that's coming, stand by those. And perhaps you will be able to profit. This verb to profit, Isaiah's used that a lot with respect to the idols, that they don't profit one. There's no profit there to be had. And here it's saying, perhaps you'll be able to profit. Perhaps you may cause trembling, and I assume in the opponents, those that might threaten them. And then verse 13, you are wearied with your many counsels. It sounds like Babylon is going from one holy man to another, to one magi to the next, trying to get the help that they need. They're going to the astrologers, those who prophesy by stars, those who predict by new moons, just running from one place to the next to get help. So God says, stand up and save you from what will come upon you. He's basically saying, I dare you to do that, because God is going to guarantee their failure. And it could be, I think this is probably the magicians, the holy men. They have become like stubble. Fire burns them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. So it's like this fire is going to sweep through and destroy all of them. Destroy them to such an extent, the fire will burn everything such that there will be no coal or wood to start a fire to warm oneself by when all of this is done. The destruction will be so complete. So have those become to you with whom you have labored. So it's, and I think this is talking about, it's either the gods or it's the representatives of the gods, the holy men, that the Babylonians, or the Babylon itself, has worked with over time, has trafficked with from her youth. They have wandered each their own way. There is none to save you. They will be of no help. There will be no salvation that will come from them. Chapter 48 now is going to turn and address, and not talk about Babylon directly, it's going to talk to the Jews, address them directly. Verse 1, hear this, O house of Jacob, who are named Israel, and who came forth from the loins of Judah, who swear by the name of the Lord and invoke the God of Israel, but not in truth nor in righteousness. For they call themselves after the holy city and lean on the God of Israel. The Lord of hosts is his name. I declared the former things long ago, and they went forth from my mouth, and I proclaimed them. Suddenly I acted, and they came to pass, because I know that you are obstinate, and your neck is an iron sinew, and your forehead bronze. Therefore I declared them to you long ago. Before they took place, I proclaimed them to you, lest you should say, my idol has done them, and my graven image and my molten image have commanded them. He's addressing the Jews. He's addressing the house of Jacob. They swear by the name of God. They invoke the God of Israel. But then it says, but not in truth, nor in righteousness. So there is a nominal identification of these Jews with the God of Israel, with Yahweh, but it is not heartfelt. It doesn't run very deep. They call themselves after the holy city. They lean on the God of Israel and the Lord of hosts, but apparently it's not a substantial faith that they have in Yahweh. God goes on to say, and we've seen this before, I declared the former things long ago. God said what was going to happen from the very beginning. And he did that so that his people would recognize that he is indeed the master of history. But, it doesn't say this, but there were long periods of time between when they were predicted and when things came to pass. And it was easy during those long periods of time to lose faith. But when God does act, it says, suddenly I acted and they came to pass. That suddenly we saw in the chapter before, and we'll see that later on in another passage we'll look at. So he predicted what he would do long in advance. There was a long period of time before those things came to pass, but when God started to move, he moved quickly. He goes on to say, because I know that you are obstinate, neck is a iron sinew, your forehead bronze, because of the obstinacy of Israel, he declared them long ago, and so that they could not say, it was my idol that performed these things. They couldn't say that it was my idol that brought us out of Egypt or whatever. God had predicted those long ago, and those cannot be attributed to some other god. Next section. You have heard, look at all this, and you, will you not declare it? I proclaim to you new things from this time, even hidden things which you have not known. They are created now and not long ago, and before today you have not heard them, lest you should say, behold, I knew them. You have not heard, you have not known, even from long ago your ear has not been opened, because I knew that you would deal very treacherously, and you have been called a rebel from birth. For the sake of my name I delay my wrath, and for my praise I restrain it for you, in order not to cut you off. Behold, I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tested you in the furnace of affliction. For my own sake, I will act. For how can my name be profaned, and my glory I will not give to another? So, God had said beforehand that these things will come to pass. These are all old hat to the people of Israel. And now they are to look at this, and look at it intently, and see what has happened. And they are to declare that which God has predicted and what God has done. He's talked before about the people of Israel being his witnesses, that God is the master of history. And now God is going to proclaim new things, things that were not announced from the very beginning, things that have been hidden. They are created now and not long ago. The they here, and we'll see that how he uses pronouns in the rest of this chapter is very difficult. It's hard to know what the antecedent of the pronoun is. But the they here, I assume, is the new things that are being predicted. That they are created now. That is, they are being now predicted and not long ago. You haven't heard them before. And the new things that are being predicted, I think, is with respect to Cyrus and coming out of exile. I think that's primarily what is in view here. Those are new predictions. Those are things that were not talked about before. And yet Isaiah is in this section predicting those things. You haven't heard these. Your ear has not been open. And that phrase has been used before in Isaiah. Early in Isaiah, God said that he was going to close their eyes and close their ears so they would not be responsive to what God had to say. And here again, their ear has not been open. He says, because I knew that you would deal very treacherously and you were a rebel from birth. So apparently the what's going on here is they are a rebellious people. And as a result, and I think this is the way it goes, as a result of their rebelliousness, God closed their eyes and ears to do things and to act in a way that builds up the wrath of God, and that then would be forthcoming. But for the sake of my name, I delay my wrath. So discipline and punishment is appropriate, but God has delayed his wrath, postponed it for a long time. And for my praise, I restrain it for you in order not to cut you off. So the wrath is not going to be the kind of wrath that will destroy them, but rather it's going to be a refining process, a disciplining process. Behold, I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tested you in the furnace of affliction. And why did he do it? He did it for his own sake, in order to save the glory for himself, preserve the glory to himself, and to grant it to no other god. And it's for that reason that he will save Israel out of Babylon. Next section. Listen to me, O Jacob, even Israel, whom I called. I am he. I am the first. I am also the last. Surely my hand founded the earth, and my right hand spread out the heavens. When I call to them, they stand together. Assemble all of you and listen. Who among them has declared these things? The Lord loves him. He shall carry out his good pleasure on Babylon, and his arm shall be against the Chaldeans. I, even I, have spoken. Indeed, I have called him. I have brought him, and he will make his ways successful. Come near to me. Listen to this. From the first I have not spoken in secret. From the time it took place, I was there. And now the Lord God has sent me and his Spirit. Now, in this section, pronouns are horrible. It's really difficult to tell what pronoun refers to whom. So I will sort this out as best I can. It starts out in 12. I am he, I am the first, I am also the last. He's used that expression before. God is the self-existent one. God is the one who was here before anything else, and he is always here. He made, he created the earth, he created the heavens, and they do his bidding. When he calls to them, they stand together. Now, I think he's calling on the Jews when he says, assemble all of you and listen. I think this is the descendants of Abraham that he's calling together and beseeching to listen to him. Who among them, who is the them? I think it must be the gods, the pagan gods. He has done that. Isaiah has done that to us before. It was several chapters ago. There was a pronoun that it was hard to know who it was referring to. And the only thing that made sense in context was the pagan gods. And I think that's what's happening here. Who among the pagan gods has declared these things? In other words, no pagan god has been able to foretell what was going to happen in the way that God has done. Then, the Lord loves him. Who is him? I think it has to be Cyrus. Lord loves Cyrus. He, Cyrus, shall carry out his, God's, good pleasure on Babylon. And his arm, his God's arm, shall be against the Chaldeans. I think it could be the other way. It could be referring to Cyrus there. Either one. So he's announcing then to the Jews that God has picked Cyrus, and Cyrus is going to do God's bidding against Babylon and against the Chaldeans. I have spoken. Indeed, I have called him. I think that's Cyrus again. I have brought him, Cyrus, and he, God, will make his, Cyrus's, ways successful. I think that's the way it has to go, but that's bizarre, the way that the pronouns are used. And there, every once in a while, there's a section in Isaiah where the pronouns are really, really difficult to assign antecedents to. Okay, so God's the one who's going to grant Cyrus his success as he goes against Babylon. Okay, so again repeating, come here, come near to me and listen. I'm the one who did this from the very beginning. It wasn't a secret. I announced it to you all. And from the time it took place, I was there. God was carrying out each of the things that he had predicted that he would carry out. Okay, in this last section, again, the pronouns are difficult. And now the Lord God has sent me and his spirit. And I'm not sure who the me is here, but my best guess is it's Isaiah. And now the Lord God has sent me, Isaiah, and his spirit. As a messenger then, I think, to the people of Israel. Okay, next section. Thus says the Lord your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. I am the Lord your God who teaches you to profit, who leads you in the way you should go. If only you had paid attention to my commandments, then your well-being would have been like a river, and your righteousness like the waves of the sea. Your descendants would have been like the sand, and your offspring like its grains. Their name would never be cut off or destroyed from my presence. So, God, the Holy One of Israel, is speaking to them directly, to the Jews. I am Yahweh, your God, who teaches you to profit. We've seen that verb before, that the idols do not do anything to profit. They are of no advantage. They are of no good. But God teaches you for benefit and leads you in the way you should go. If only the Jews had paid attention to his commandments, then their well-being is the translation that I have here, but the Hebrew word is shalom. So it's peace, well-being. Then your shalom would have been like a river. If they had been faithful, if they had been obedient, God would have showered his goodwill on them. And it would have been abundant peace and your righteousness like the wave of the sea. Not only that, their descendants would have been like the sand, the grains of sand, and their name would never be cut off or destroyed from God's presence. That's what would have happened had they been obedient to his commandments. The last section. Go forth from Babylon. Flee from the Chaldeans. Declare with the sound of joyful shouting. Proclaim this. Send it out to the end of the earth. Say, the Lord has redeemed his servant Jacob, and they did not thirst when he led them through the deserts. He made the water flow out of the rock for them. He split the rock, and the water gushed forth. There is no peace for the wicked, says the Lord. So what Isaiah or God is doing in this section is trying to make his case as to why the people of Israel should be loyal to him and obedient to him rather than staying in Babylon, being loyal to the gods of Babylon. And God has had to make that case. At this point then, he says, go out from Babylon. Leave all of that behind and follow me. Go forth from Babylon and declare with the sound of joyful shouting, proclaim this, send it out to the end of the earth. Say, the Lord has redeemed his servant Jacob. That what's happening here is a redemption of the people of Israel from the slavery in Babylon. And so they are to declare this to the world, and they are to go out from Babylon in the same way that the Jews were called out when they were called out of Egypt left. When they were called out of Egypt, they were called out of slavery, but there was a sense in which there was security there. There was even a measure of comfort there. At least there was food and water. And God called them out. And where did he call them out into? He called them out into the desert, where there was nothing. And now he's calling them out of Babylon, a place of relative comfort, They've got food and water. They've got what they need to live. And God is saying, come out of there. Be loyal to me rather than being loyal to the gods of Babylon. And, hearkening back to the Exodus, I took care of you in the wilderness. I provided water out of rocks. And I can provide water for you in the desert again. So come out of Babylon. You know, you're leaving a comfortable place. You're going where things are uncertain. But just as I cared for your ancestors in the desert, I will care for you as well. Then the last verse, there is no peace. There is no shalom for the wicked, says the Lord. Don't be deluded. Staying in Babylon is not being in a place of peace. Peace cannot be found there. Peace can only come from following me, going where I direct you to go. Okay, there are a couple of things I want to talk about here. The first is, I would like to talk a little bit about the attitude of Babylon as God describes it. Babylon said, I am and there is no one besides me. Babylon lived as though there would never be judgment, as though Babylon would never be held accountable for its actions. That struck me as I was looking through this. As a culture here in America, it seems to me that we have reached the point where the vast majority of our comrades are living as if there will be no judgment. My son heard a talk by a prominent Israeli, and in the question and answer period of the talk, he was asked if he was optimistic about the future of Israel. And his response to that was, if you had asked me a few weeks ago, I would have said no. But, he said, I've just spent some time in America. And he said, Israel is a corrupt society. There's a lot of corruption. But he said, America is even more corrupt. Most of it is legal, but it's more corrupt. But, he said, I see in America the dynamics for change and that turning around. And he said, and I think that there are the seeds of that in Israel as well. I thought that was very interesting. I disagree with him. I don't see those same seeds that he thinks that he sees. But it was interesting to me to hear him characterize America as being corrupt. Because certainly growing up, and my experience growing up, I didn't think of America as being a corrupt society. Now, as I was growing up, I was looking at America through child eyes. And now I look at things through adult eyes, and there is a difference there. But it does seem to me that America has become increasingly corrupt over the years of my life, and I would say particularly in recent years. Our politicians are corrupt, using their power for their own advantage. Our bureaucracy is corrupt, abusing people, not treating them as human beings, and abusing their power. Our business leaders are corrupt, taking advantage of their workers, taking advantage of their customers. Our workers are corrupt, taking advantage of their employers and taking advantage of the unemployed. We're all complicit. We're all corrupt. We have all turned a blind eye to much of the corruption that's around us, the corruption of the politicians, the corruption of the business leaders, and we work hard to protect the trinkets that they pass out. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around, but a lot of the corruption, I think, stems from a perspective that we will never be held accountable for this. I remember watching a travel log. It was a Rick Steves show. He was in Prague, and he went to this church that's someplace in Prague. And he said, there's the main entrance to this church, and then on both sides of the main entrance, there are other entrances to the church. On one side, and I can't remember whether it was on the right side or the left side, above the door, it had a depiction of the Last Judgment. And he said, when anybody was ever crowned king, to go to their coronation ceremony, they had to go through the door with the last judgment over the door. That's really interesting, because if you look at the power of a sovereign in Europe and compare that with the power of a sovereign in the East, there is a significant difference. And this was pointed out to me by a Russian historian, because Russia's caught right in the middle between the East and the West. In the East, the sovereign has absolute power, absolute authority, and can do whatever he wants. And in fact, in Russian culture, for a period of time, it became common for the Tsar to declare something, make some kind of promise, and then later go back on the promise to show that he can do whatever he wants to do. He's not even bound by his own word. In the West, on the other hand, it was always taught, it was always the theory of the divine right of kings. The king can do anything. But the king never felt the freedom to do just anything, because there was always the final judgment that was there in the back of their minds. They always thought that they were going to be held accountable before God someday for that which they do. A huge restraining force on the kings in Europe. We should all walk through that door occasionally. That we are all going to stand before God naked by ourselves and give an accounting for what we do in life. There will be no protests of innocence. I didn't do it. That will be no good. God will know what we've done. We will know what we've done. And everything will come to light. And as a result, we need to live every moment of our lives today in recognition of the fact that we will one day be accountable for everything that we do. The other thing I want to talk about in here is the last section of chapter 48. It says, get out of Babylon, go forth from Babylon. Why did God want the Jews to get out of Babylon? Well, he wants them to go to Judah. He wants them to rebuild the cities of Judah and to rebuild the temple. But it doesn't say, get out of Babylon and go to Judah. It only talks about that first part, get out of Babylon. So the emphasis is not on what they're supposed to do someplace else, but the emphasis is on getting out of here. Why get out of Babylon? Babylon was not the most cruel nation. It wasn't the most brutal nation. Assyria probably would have had that claim to fame. In fact, the Jews lived fairly well in Babylon. Many of them became wealthy and became very comfortable there. So he's not commanding them to leave because they're in an uncomfortable situation. I suspect that his concern is that Babylon was culturally seductive. It appealed to the senses. It talks about Babylon being sensual. It appealed to the senses. It sucked people in. And it got people to worship the gods of Babylon. So what God is saying is, when the time comes, you gotta leave. That's not a good place. It's not a healthy place. It's toxic. Now, does that statement have any relevance to us? Well, this passage has an echo in Revelation 18, and I'll just read that quickly. And you'll see that there are several indications that this is hearkening back to the chapters that we just looked at. Revelation 18, verse 1. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. And she has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. And the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. And the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, and that you may not receive of her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, and I am not a widow, and will never see mourning. For this reason, in one day her plagues will come, pestilence, and mourning, and famine, and she will be burned up with fire. For the Lord God who judges her is strong. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and live sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, Woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city. For in one hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys her cargo anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made from very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives. And the fruit you long for has gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. The merchants of these things, who became rich from her, will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, Woe, woe, the great city! She who was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in one hour such great wealth has been laid waste. And every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor and as many as make their living by the sea stood at a distance and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, What city is like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, Woe, woe, the great city in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in one hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her. I'll stop there. But you can see how many parallels there are between this and those passages in Isaiah, suggesting that what's being talked about in Isaiah with respect to Babylon, where the Jews are living, that is a foreshadowing of an event yet to come, where another Babylon is going to fall. And this new Babylon, this other Babylon, is going to have many of the same characteristics of the Babylon that was talked about in Isaiah and will be destroyed completely. And once again, the people of God are called out, Come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins and that you may not receive of her plagues. I don't know exactly what this event that's being talked about in Revelation is going to look like. I don't know if anyone knows exactly what it's going to look like. I don't know what it means to say, come out of Babylon. So, I'll read from Jacques Ellul. Jacques Ellul, in his book, The Meaning of the City, which is a great book, I recommend it to everybody. In this book, he argues that city in the Bible has become an image, a metaphor. City has become a metaphor for the concentration of human evil. And as you go through the Bible and read about cities, that oftentimes that's the significance that's being attached to them. And in the middle of the book here, he's talking about this passage, where he's talking about where Isaiah says, come out of Babylon. And as he's introducing this section, he talks about the importance of us as believers of living in the city. He goes on to make the point later that the city may be a cesspool of wickedness, but interestingly, in the new heavens and the new earth, we will live in a city, Jerusalem. He hasn't called us out to the wilderness. He's going to put us in another city, but it will be a redeemed city. But in our experience, the city is an apt metaphor for the wickedness of man concentrated. But he insists that in this life, we should work for the good of the city rather than leaving it. We should work for the good of the city. He goes on to say, but don't build it. And he doesn't really explain that metaphor very well. But it's don't contribute to its evil. And he says, he points out, it's just a reality that we run the risk of the city destroying us because it is going to see us as adversaries of the public welfare. That just our presence in it and our presence as agents of servants of God is going to put us in a position where we will be at odds with the city itself. Therefore, he says, what we need to be doing in the city is to proclaim what's true, proclaim the judgment, and pray. But, he argues, there are several times in the Bible, Sodom and Gomorrah, Egypt, Babylon, there are a number of times when God has said, come out. He calls his people out of the city. He argues that it's when a judgment has happened. I don't know that that quite fits with Babylon, but that's what he argues. It's when judgment has happened and hearts are hardened such that there is nothing left to do. That's when he calls people out. Now, I want to read one paragraph out of Lewell's book. Christians are called to separate themselves not fearfully or because of rumors, wars, and rulers, but when God will tell them to do so. How? Their task is neither to try to discover his means nor to speculate vainly. God will tell them how to act when he tells them to act. And when the time has come, God's people will know with a sure knowledge, with a certitude not discernible from the outside, not measurable intellectually, but absolutely undeniable, that the time has come to leave Babylon. Nonetheless, one text might provide us with a sign, which in no way removes the unpredictability of the event and God's own liberty. He quotes from Jeremiah 50, verse 8. Flee from the midst of Babylon and go out of the land of the Chaldeans and be as he-goats before the flock. In this departure, our first thoughts are not with how to get out of the predicament. It is not the departure of individuals fleeing before a catastrophe, but the departure of all God's people gathered into a flock. What is astonishing is that in this prophecy, those who understand God's will are likened to he-goats, the leaders of a flock. And so, in this departure, it seems not only that faithful Christians separate themselves from the city, but that they are the guides for still others, men whom God has chosen in secret and who perhaps have never confessed Jesus Christ or belonged to any confession, but who nevertheless belong to God's people and prove it at the decisive moment by hearing the word of judgment and salvation that the church is announcing to the world. When Noah and Lot preached the word, they received only mockery. Yet we must think, too, of Nineveh listening to Jonah's prophecy. When the church leaves the city, she must lead out men who have never paid any attention to the word, but who now receive it. Mysterious people whom we will be surprised to see, a people who are around us and whose existence is certified by the word of God spoken to Paul. Quote, speak, for I have many people in this city. Acts 18:10. It seems to me, I'm neither an optimist nor a pessimist, I'm a realist. It seems to me that we are living in truly dark times. I am stunned on occasion thinking about how much has changed and changed for the worse in the last decade or so. I mourn the brokenness and the darkness in which we live, and I don't know how long remains until judgment comes. But I do think that the time to leave is nearing. I don't know when. I don't know where to. I don't know how to leave. But I do think that the time is nearing. And I trust that Elul is correct, that God will somehow let us know when that time is and where it is that we are to go. Okay. Questions or comments?
When they say Babylon or Chaldeans, I'm a little confused. I thought Chaldeans were an earlier civilization.
I believe that's right, but they are related peoples. I mean, it's a related culture, a direct relationship.
Would it be like saying, like American, well, like English and German come from, like some of the same, like the Anglo-Saxons and so on, or like Europeans in general, would you...
Yeah, it's
I mean,
like
kind of like that.
It's like, let's see, what's it like? Yeah, British or English?
Mm-hmm. Or well, maybe Celt. It's probably more like it. Mm-hmm. With
it's that kind of thing. The Chaldeans, the way that Isaiah is using here, it's always in parallel with Babylon. They're synonymous for him.
Since there's so much like going back and forth and using examples and so on in this. It made me think that while they're talking about the virgin daughter of Babylon, I think that relates to a lot of the matriarchic religions that were happening in ancient times. Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon for a lot of them to have a woman and a child. Mm-hmm. And the child being born either miraculously after the husband dies or God impregnated him or something like that. And so I'm thinking that may be kind of what they're talking about. Some people have speculated that it may be the devil trying to mimic or, how can I say, make a bad example through what happened to Jesus and so on.
Mm-hmm. So you're thinking that's the reason for the term the virgin daughter, Babylon? Is that what you're thinking?
Yes, I'm kind of thinking because I think Isaiah or educated people would have known about this, about the, you know, the matriarchal and this type of woman with a child and miraculous birth and so on, and not necessarily outright saying that it was a virgin birth, but some type of miraculous happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a student of a lot of different cultures and so on, and in the ancient, if you go back far enough, there's almost always this type of woman and child and a miraculous type of birth.
In the term, O virgin daughter, there's not necessarily any allusion to virgin birth there. That's just young daughter. And whether that's related to what you're saying, that a lot of the gods of the ancient world were females, I don't know.
But and then have you ever heard of Semiramis?
Pardon?
Semiramis, there's some sources that she supposedly was a mother of Nimrod. Mm-hmm. And that I think it's after he died, she had another child, and there was this type of like Nimrod didn't impregnate her, she was impregnated by him when he became a god. And so you can see a lot of parallels with Egypt and some of the other ones, particularly with Egypt, that ties in, and also the name of Seti and Seth with actual killing of the god. But anyway, that's...
The setup is Isaiah's writing this prophecy 150 years before they go into exile, right?
Yes. Well, 100, it's not that. It's about... between 50 and 70 years before they go into exile.
Okay. Was it their habit? Did they have synagogues in Babylon at that time? And were they reading the scriptures? And so they would have come to this passage? And would the exiles have heard Isaiah's prophecy and reflected on them, right. their their future role to go back to the land, to the, etc.?
They think that the first synagogues were developed while they were in Babylon in exile. And yeah, so presumably this is part of what they're studying and reading and thinking about, and presumably, yeah, this would have had that kind of impact, at least on some people. Pretty interesting. Okay, thanks.